From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Today we talk with David Blight, who this week received the Pulitzer Prize for his book Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom, cited as a breathtaking history. Blight tells us about Douglass's escape from slavery, his passionate leadership in the abolitionist movement, his complicated personal life, and the gifts as an orator and writer that made him a national celebrity.
Seeing and hearing Douglass became, through the course of the 19th century, a kind of American wonder of the world. If you came to America, you wanted to see Douglass speak, if you could. It was that kind of an event.
Also, an excerpt of our interview with Aretha Franklin, honored this week with a Pulitzer Special Citation for her contribution to American music and culture. That and more on today's Fresh Air. The Pulitzer Prize for History was awarded this week to historian David Blight for his book about 19th century abolitionist Frederick Douglass. Douglass is best known for his autobiographies, which describe his experiences as a slave and his escape to freedom. Blight's book also illuminates less well-known parts of Douglass's long and remarkable life: his break with leading abolitionist William Lloyd Garrison, his complicated personal life, his support for and bitter feud with leaders of the women's suffrage movement, and his years as a Republican Party functionary when he took patronage jobs in the government. Douglass was a passionate writer and powerful orator, and Blight says the most photographed person in the 19th century. David Blight is a professor of history at Yale and the author or editor of a dozen books, including annotated editions of Douglass's first two autobiographies. I spoke to him last year when his book, Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom, was first published. Well, David Blight, welcome back to Fresh Air. Tell us about Frederick Douglass' early life. Where was he born? What was his life like as a slave?
Well, first, thank you, Dave. It's great to be back on Fresh Air. Frederick Douglass was born along a horseshoe bend in the Tuckahoe River on the eastern shore of Maryland in 1818. It's a kind of a remote backwater at that point of the American Slave Society. He was born on the Home Hill Farm, which was owned by his then master, Aaron Anthony. His mother was a still young woman named Harriet Bailey. He was probably born in his grandmother Betsy Bailey's cabin, although we don't know for sure. And he never will know exactly who his father was, although one candidate is Aaron Anthony himself. Douglass was always told that his father was his master, or one of his masters. So one of the facts of his youth that everyone should know is that he was, in essence, an orphan. He never knew his father, and he never saw his mother after the age of six, and he had to practically invent images of her. He had very little memory of her. So as a child, he's essentially not altogether abandoned, but he's left without parents. And then he grows up for 20 years as a slave, about 11 of them on the Eastern Shore, and about 9 of those years in Baltimore, which, in fact, the city has everything to do with the fact that he would ever be able to escape.
Right. In Baltimore, he lived among a lot of freed black men, right, and women.
That's right. That's right. Baltimore was a great ocean port and a great shipbuilding city. And when in the year he escaped, 1838, Baltimore had about 130,000 people. It was a big ocean port city. It only had about 3,000 slaves, but it had about 17,000 free blacks. It was a very large, very active, energetic, free black community, and he grows up amidst them as well, especially amidst them. And it's there that he would have met Anna Murray, who became his first wife, probably when he was 18 or 19. He got involved in three or four different churches. He was involved in a debating society. And he had a relative freedom of movement within the city on its confines. But he also had this visual and emotional and imaginative window on the world with the ocean port, with all the great ships that would come in and out of Baltimore Harbor. And it's there that he discovered his literacy and his eventual genius with words and language. It's there where he first began to cultivate his his abilities as an orator and even probably his abilities as a writer.
Right. He was fortunate in that Sophia Auld, who was the wife of his then owner, started teaching him the alphabet, and he built on that and learned to read kind of in an enterprising way with other sources. How did he come to escape? Can't have been easy.
No, it wasn't easy. It was a brave plan. He hatched it with Anna, his fiancée at the time, as well as a few other people, clearly, who were in on the planning. He got on a train in late August, 1838, and by three train rides and three boat rides across rivers, he ended up in New York City in about 38 hours at the base of Chambers Street, right down in the lower Manhattan on the Hudson River side. It was an extraordinary escape through what one might call the Underground Railroad, but he did this essentially all on his own with Anna's help.
They made their way to Massachusetts. Was it New Bedford? Do I have that right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And then
the whaling town.
Right. He works and ends up becoming quite an orator at an early age. How did that happen?
Well, he'd already practiced oratory even while he was a slave. And it gave the young Douglas, the teenager, a source of power, a source of something he was good at. He was good at getting on his feet and just trying to speak. Now, he wasn't well-formed yet by any means, but when he gets to New Bedford, he's 21, 22, and 23 years old. They lived there 3 years. He worked down in the docks. He worked in a foundry. He did all kinds of odd jobs, but he very quickly joined the local AME Zion Church, a black church, and within a year or so, they had him preaching. They said, this kid can preach, put him up front. And he then learns to preach from the text, which is, of course, the Protestant tradition. And it's there in that AME Zion Church, as well as a couple public meetings, where he gets discovered, so to speak, by the Massachusetts abolitionists who are disciples of William Lloyd Garrison. And in the late summer of 1841, they invited this very young man, he's 23 years old, out to Nantucket to a big anti-slavery convention. And it was there in the Athenaeum on Nantucket where he gave his first speech to a room full of abolitionists, a room full of white people. And in essence, he got up and told some of his stories about his youth, about being a slave. And he was a hit, a huge hit. And they hired him to then go out on the road as an itinerant lecturer across New England at first, and eventually within a year or two, all across the northern states.
He eventually becomes and establishes several newspapers, and for the next 20 years becomes an activist for abolition. How did Frederick Douglass's views about the means to abolish slavery evolve between then and the Civil War?
Yes, that's a fascinating aspect of his life, because he undergoes a kind of ideological, strategic, even intellectual transformation in the late 1840s, early 1850s. I think it's the first great transformation of his public life. He also had quite a breakdown in this period. He could barely make ends meet for his family. He's trying to be the self-made man who could not provide. But he embraced, for example, things like the possible uses of violence. And that's in the wake, one must know, of the Fugitive Slave Act, which radicalized a lot of people. The Fugitive Slave Act of 1850 made everyone complicitous with returning fugitive slaves to their owners if they could be found. And by 1851, 1852, Douglass is writing editorials with lines such as, why do slave catchers fear having their throats cut? It's because they deserve to have them cut. He also embraced political parties vehemently. He came to see that if you don't attack the law and you don't find a way to change the power at the base of slavery, you would never destroy it. So he's moving, not only moving away from Garrison, he's moving full force into the politics of anti-slavery. It's not going to be a smooth ride by any means through the 1850s, but by 51 and 52, he's become a thoroughgoing political abolitionist, believing in political parties, believing in political activism. And I also should say here that this moment, when he does have a real emotional breakdown, he spent days at a time bedridden, even with paralytic limbs, he said, and he couldn't even work on the newspaper. It's also a period in which he wrote some of his greatest works, which has probably been true of lots of great writers, but it is certainly true of Douglas.
As he becomes a celebrated author and speaker, he has a wife, Anna, who never learns to read and write, right? What was that relationship like as far as we
know? Well, over time it became very difficult. One has to be honest about it. The man who becomes the most famous African-American writer, orator, intellectual in the world was married to a woman who remained largely illiterate. She did not share his intellectual life or his professional life. Anna almost never traveled with him, and he traveled all the time as an itinerant orator. So it became with time a very traditional marriage. Anna ran the house. She was a brilliant domestic woman. But as a marriage in which he could share his intellectual curiosity and enormous ambition, that was not that kind of marriage. Douglas never wrote much of anything about Anna in his 1,200 pages of autobiography. There's one mention of his wife Anna, and she's called my wife. He also didn't write much about his children, at least in the autobiographies. We have a lot of letters where we can get at those relationships, but Douglas did not discuss his more personal standing in his life in his many, many pages of autobiography.
Douglas watched the crises over slavery build towards the Civil War. He was prepared to see a war in order to see slavery ended. What was his attitude towards Abraham Lincoln? Did they have a relationship?
Douglas did have a relationship with Lincoln, but not until the war years. Douglas first became aware of Lincoln during the Lincoln-Douglas debates. He followed in the newspapers, and Douglas was even out in Illinois during one or two of the debates.
And we should note this is not Lincoln versus Frederick Douglass.
Stephen Douglas, right. Yeah, for the Senate race in 1858. He became intrigued with Lincoln then, and of course, 2 years later, Lincoln runs for president. But their relationship was very testy at first. Douglas was one of Lincoln's most ferocious critics in the first year or year and a half of the war because the war wasn't being made against slavery, and they were even trying to return fugitive slaves. So before they ever met, Douglas had said some of the harshest things any critic of Lincoln had ever said.
But things changed over the course of the war? I guess the Emancipation Proclamation was probably critical there.
It was absolutely critical. Into 1862, Douglas was still hammering away at Lincoln. At one point, he called him the most powerful slave catcher in the country. But after the preliminary proclamation, September 62, and of course the final proclamation, January of 63, Douglas's tune on Lincoln greatly changed. And then especially with the recruiting of black soldiers in the wake of the Emancipation Proclamation, and Douglas got deeply involved personally in recruiting members of the 54th Massachusetts Regiment. Two of his own sons were members of that regiment. He slowly but surely changes his tune about Lincoln. He comes to see the war now as a crusade led by Lincoln and the Republicans to not only save the Union, but do it by destroying slavery. He would everywhere he got a chance to say it, he would say, freedom to the slave is freedom to the nation. Freedom to the slave is the preservation of the Union.
You know, when he was a young abolitionist, Frederick Douglass, like William Lloyd Garrison, didn't think the U.S. Constitution could be used to grant true equality. He came to regard it differently and saw the Civil War as a chance for, in a way, a second American Revolution. And, of course, the question was whether the slaves in the South would truly be given the rights of citizenship. And in 1866, he leads a delegation of blacks to meet with Andrew Johnson, who had become president after Lincoln's assassination, himself essentially a white supremacist. What happens at this meeting?
It's an extraordinary meeting, and it's a debacle. Douglas leads his delegation, February 1866, of about 12 black men to the White House to meet with Johnson, to talk to him about black civil and political rights. And because at that point, the nature of the Reconstruction laws and the soon-to-be 14th Amendment was all up in the air. The debates were just beginning to happen in Congress, and there was Andrew Johnson seemingly standing in the way of it all. And did he ever. They had a bitter and terrible exchange that lasted almost an hour. Andrew Johnson gave a speech to this delegation that Douglas led, a bitter speech. He blamed black people for the war. He told them they should really colonize themselves outside of the country. They should really leave. That political rights, especially the right to vote, were just never really going to be possible. And when Douglas tried at times to interrupt or interject, Johnson would tell him to be quiet and just listen. And they were forced, basically, to listen. Douglas finally, toward the end of this meeting, got in a few lines and a few questions. He demanded the right to vote. He said the right to vote for black people is ultimate peace and freedom to the whole country. But as they were leaving, Andrew Johnson was overheard saying, and it was recorded even in the newspaper, that Douglas, he's just like every other N-word I've ever known. He'll as soon cut your throat as anything. And Douglas overheard that. This is the President of the United States. Douglas then went back, and with his oldest son, Lewis, who was at this meeting, they wrote a kind of a manifesto letter that was published denouncing Andrew Johnson and protesting. But most importantly, Douglas did what he always did. He went to his desk and he wrote a barn burner of a speech. He called it The Perils to the Republic. It was a speech of warning, you know, that Andrew Johnson stands in the way here of the fruition of the victories of the Civil War. And he took that speech on the road in the summer of 1866. He's still giving it in 1867. And it has so many modern echoes today, especially the line where he says, "It is all well and good. Our Constitution and our laws are all well and good when a good man is president. But what do we do with our laws and our Constitution when a bad man is president?" He was, of course, referring to Andrew Johnson. But this is the what's fascinating about that encounter is that it's at this moment of revolutionary change and all things seem possible about Reconstruction in the South and in the Constitution, if it can be enacted, if it can be done over the veto power of the president. But it's quite an encounter, and there's really never been another meeting quite as bad between any other president and a delegation of black leaders.
Frederick Douglass is known as a real champion of women's suffrage. I think he was the only male speaker at the Seneca Falls meeting in 1848, right?
Yes, he's the only male speaker. He wasn't the only male signer of the Declaration of Sentiments at Seneca Falls, but he was the only black person even attending it.
Right.
He embraced women's suffrage early and often.
Except
he got into a big problem later.
Well, that's what I wanted to get to. He right. befriended Elizabeth Cady Stanton, and in the end, they had a falling out. It was over principle,
yes.
right? What happened?
Well, there were competing principles, of course. When it came time for the 15th Amendment, the Voting Rights Amendment, that passed in 1869, Douglas had a terrible falling out with Susan Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton, who were and others, but they were the two great leaders of the women's suffrage movement. And the whole debate was essentially about whether women would be included in the Voting Rights Amendment, and they were not. And the reason, of course, was that everyone with one eye open knew that if you put women's suffrage into that amendment, it never would have passed first the Congress and certainly wouldn't have passed in the state legislatures. So Douglas took the position that, as he put it, it was the black man's hour. And this was the one chance to get the right to vote for black men, and that for now women would have to once again wait. Well, Stanton and Anthony had run out of patience. They weren't going to wait any longer. But the problem was they pushed back and fought back with racist language, terribly racist language against Douglas and against black men generally. And Douglas handled most of that as a gentleman with grace, except he also threw about some rather stereotypical claims. For example, he said, well, educated women can still have their husbands voting and their husbands can vote their interest, which rings pretty badly on our ears today. But it was one of those moments when you had to make choices, and he took the choice of favoring the 15th Amendment because it got at least black male suffrage into the Constitution.
David Blight has been awarded a Pulitzer Prize for his book, Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom. After a break, he'll talk about how in his later years, Douglass, the radical, became more of an establishment figure in the Republican Party. We'll remember the late Aretha Franklin, who was also recognized with a Pulitzer Prize special citation and whose 1972 gospel performance is the subject of a new documentary film. And Justin Chang reviews the new film Long Day's Journey in Tonight. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, REI Co-op. We all have wild ideas, but rarely do we get to see our wildest ideas come to life. Started by adventure journalist Shelby Stanger and brought to you by REI, Wild Ideas Worth Living is a podcast that explores everything from mindfulness in school to adventures in space, overcoming fear, and learning how to unplug. Ideas that started big and wild and never stopped growing. Learn more or listen now. Search for Wild Ideas Worth Living.
We're listening to my interview with historian David Blight. He won a Pulitzer Prize this week for his biography of 19th century abolitionist Frederick Douglass. You know, he became committed to the Republican Party. And one of the most interesting things, I think, about the last half of your book is we see Frederick Douglass become a political insider. I mean, this guy who was a radical outsider, he gets patronage jobs. And the interesting thing is that as he embraces the Republican Party in the last half of the 19th century, it is a party that has essentially abandoned, you know, the effort to grant blacks real citizenship in the South. It is becoming increasingly the party of big business. You know, it's tariffs, it's free trade, it's anti-labor unions.
Does he
go with all of that?
He goes along with it. He never gives up on the Republican Party. He had nowhere else to go politically. He used to say, you know, the Republican Party is the ship and all else is the sea. There was no other political home for blacks. The problem was the Republican Party, as you say, moves away from enforcement of the Reconstruction Act, moves away from the Southern problem, moves away from enforcement of black voting rights and civil rights. And even moves away from enforcement against terrorist groups, for God's sake. It's a difficult thing for him. And he does levy some pretty brutal criticisms of the Republican Party over time, but it's from within the party. He always campaigned for the Republican candidate. He always said it is still the party of emancipation. It is still the party that saved the Union. And it must somehow find its way back to its creeds, even when it was pretty clear it was not. And this was, as I said, one of the disputes he has with a new generation of black leadership who is asking, should they remain loyal to a party that no longer really speaks for their interest?
In 1877, after this, well, in the later years of a very long and distinguished career, at which he is a very well-known and respected orator and writer, he goes to Maryland and tracks down his former master, Thomas Auld. What do we know of this meeting?
It's an amazing meeting. Thomas Auld, Douglass believed, was on his deathbed. He turned out not to die for roughly another year. But he went back to St. Michael's on the Eastern Shore, the very town in which Auld had held him as a teenage slave and beaten him, by the way, and then rented him out to other, you know, slaveholders at times as a field hand. But he went back, he met Auld with great publicity, he had press in tow, and he went to Auld's bed, and they met for about 20 or 25 minutes. Douglas tells us they both shed tears. It was a kind of a meeting of epochs and eras. By then, Auld, of course, knew how famous Douglas was. But Douglas quite directly appears to have asked Auld, "Are you my father?" Or in some way he asked him. He's trying to find out his birth, his paternity, his roots, and so on. But Auld did not say, "Yes, I'm your father." Maybe he couldn't. I don't know. And my own guess is that Auld is probably not his father, but that's a pure guess, educated guess, I guess.
And did they talk about their relationship of ownership and bondage?
They did, and to some degree, according to Douglas, who is he's his own eyewitness for this, you have to remember. Yeah, they did, and I think Douglas also brought up the fact that he had befriended Auld's children, his daughter and son, just to try to understand, probably, whether they were actually kin. But even more importantly, on that visit, Douglas went over to Easton, Maryland, where he gave incredible speech in an old black church, and then he went out to the Tuckahoe River, to the Horseshoe Bend, on a cold November day, dug his hands down in the soil where he believed his grandmother Betsy's cabin would have stood, trying to see if he could understand where in his imagination he could find his mother in that soil, where he could find his grandmother in that soil, how he could even understand who he was, and most importantly, he was always trying to understand how could a slave boy from that spot become who he became. How could a kid as a slave from that side of the Chesapeake cross the Chesapeake and become this world-class orator, writer, and thinker, and even statesman? He was always trying to even grasp and understand his own story as he kept telling it.
In a speech in 1875, he got a lot of attention when he seemed to sort of condemn some charitable efforts aimed at blacks and mm-hmm. kind of embraced the idea of black self-reliance. And this is which causes modern-day conservatives and even libertarians to claim him as one of their own. What was his view?
Well, he early and often favored self-reliance for his fellow black people. Virtually all black leaders in the 19th century preached a kind of self-reliance. What else could they do in a society that either enslaved them, segregated them, defined them out of the Constitution, and later on, of course, even used terror to eliminate them? So self-reliance was a matter of inevitable necessity in some ways. But what modern conservatives, as you said, especially the libertarians, have done is they've plucked out a speech from 1875, but many others too, before that and after that, where Douglas would answer the question, what does the Negro want, which was always bandied about, and his answer would be, let him alone, leave him alone, let him alone, and he would say, give him fair play, which meant enforce the law, enforce his or her rights, don't kill them when they're trying to vote, and so forth. But what modern conservatives have done is they plucked out pieces of rhetoric here and there, and they've said, aha, you see, Douglas was not only a Republican, but he believed in individualism and self-reliance and self-help, which meant he didn't advocate for government assistance and so forth. I have to say, it's a terrible misuse and appropriation of Douglas because it ignores, I would argue, 80 or 90% of the rest of his ideas and the rest of his life. He was not anti-government in the least. He believed in activist, interventionist use of federal power to destroy slavery, to destroy the Confederacy, and to reconceive the U.S. Constitution. But it's what we do with historical figures. But it's often a rather slippery misuse of the past. He did preach self-reliance. There's no question about that. But you have to go back into that context and understand why.
David Blythe, thanks so much for speaking with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Dave.
David Blythe won the Pulitzer Prize for History for his book, Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom. Coming up, we remember Aretha Franklin, who was also honored this week with a Pulitzer Prize special citation. This is Fresh Air.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Going Through It, a new MailChimp original podcast hosted by Ann Friedman. Listen as Ann sits down with guests such as Rebecca Traister, Soledad O'Brien, Samin Nosrat, and Hillary Clinton to hear about the pivotal moments in their lives, careers, and relationships when they had to decide whether to quit or keep going. Subscribe and listen on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, Ophira Eisenberg here, host of NPR's Hour of Puzzles, Word Games, and Trivia, Ask Me Another. This month, we're celebrating women in comedy, and this week, we're joined by Retta. You may know her from her role on NBC's Parks and Recreation or her new series, Good Girls. Listen and subscribe now.
When Pulitzer Prize winners were announced earlier this week, Aretha Franklin was honored with a special citation for what the jury called her indelible contribution to American music and culture for more than five decades. Franklin died last August at the age of 76. Her talents are also being celebrated with the release of a new documentary about her gospel performance recorded in 1972 at the New Temple Missionary Baptist Church in Watts, Los Angeles. Sidney Pollack directed a version of the film decades ago, but it was never released because of problems synchronizing the images and sound. Digital experts have solved those problems, and the film, called Amazing Grace, is now in theaters. Today we're going to hear some of Terry's conversation with Aretha Franklin, recorded in 1999. We'll start with an excerpt of that gospel performance in 1972.
Whoa!
Talk a little bit about the influences on you during your formative years. Your father, the Reverend C.L. Franklin, he was one of the most popular preachers of his generation. He was nationally known through his tours and through, I think, radio broadcasts as well as recordings. You say in the book that church nurses carried smelling salts to revive worshipers who were overcome to the point of fainting by the Spirit or by your father's sermons. What was it like for you to watch your father speak and people fainting in church?
Well, it was tremendous. I love going to church, but as a young girl, I certainly enjoyed watching and listening to my dad.
You toured with your father through churches through the Deep South, and I'm wondering what it was like for you during the days of segregation to tour through the Deep South, you know, how that compared to what you were used to in Detroit?
Well, it certainly was not what I was used to or accustomed to in Detroit. There were times that we were asked to go to the back of the restaurant, say, or we couldn't use the bathrooms. We got information that golf You could use the bathrooms there if you – and we didn't buy gas where we could not use the restrooms. So we went to golf a lot, I must tell you.
Many singers who grew up in the church weren't allowed by their parents to listen to or to perform pop music. It wasn't that way in your family. What did your father think about pop music and jazz?
My dad, I think, appreciated gifted artists. We just didn't have that problem in our home. Rockin' with Leroy used to come on when I would come in from school. It was a very, very big R&B broadcast of the day when I was a young girl. My dad really appreciated music, and he never tried to limit us in any way with respect to music or anything like that.
Well, as you describe in your new autobiography, great performers like Nat Cole and Art Tatum knew your father and would sometimes be in your living room at the piano. That must have been
something. Yes, that's true. Art Tatum was often a visitor in our home. He was a very good friend of my dad's, Oscar Peterson, and Arthur Prysock, Mahalia Jackson, of course, James, and he loved Sam Cooke. And he just really very broadly appreciated one's artistry when they were truly gifted and really good.
Friends with Sam Cooke, the great gospel singer turned soul singer. How did you meet?
Sam and I met at a Sunday evening program that we had at our church back in the early 50s. And I was sitting there waiting for the program to start after church, and I just happened to look back over my shoulder. And I saw this group of people coming down the aisle, and oh my God, the man that was leading them, Sam, and his brother LC, and these guys were really super sharp. They had on beautiful blue and navy blue and brown trench coats, and I had never seen anyone quite as attractive, not a male as attractive as Sam was. And so prior to the program, my soul was kind of being stirred in another way.
Well, now, he crossed over from gospel to pop before you did. What impact did it have on you when you heard him having a hit pop song on the radio?
We were going down the highway. We were somewhere in the South. And my sister and I and the driver and maybe one or two other people in the car, we knew that he had left the gospel field, and of course I was rather sad about that. But as we were driving, we knew that he had recorded, and just out of the dark came this fabulous voice, and it was Sam, and it was his first record, and he was singing "You Send Me," and there was just pandemonium in the car. My sister and I just had a fit. Oh my God, it's Sam, it's Sam. It's his record, you know. It was like that. You Send Me, this is, it's his record, you know. And there was just so much excitement in the car, the driver really had to pull over.
So did that make you think, maybe I should consider making pop records?
Well, I don't know at the time. I don't think that was my feeling, and it wasn't to begin with. I was interested in changing fields as well, but I was not as confident, I guess, as Sam was to begin with. And finally, I said, well, if Sam made it, maybe I could too. And I was willing to give it a try.
In 1966, after your contract with Columbia Records was up, you moved to Atlantic Records, which was the home of rhythm and blues greats like the Drifters, the Clovers, Ruth Brown, and Ray Charles. The producer Jerry Wexler took you down to a studio in Muscle Shoals, Alabama, that was famous for its great session men, which included Dan Penn and Spooner Oldham. Now, Spooner Oldham tells the story that when he heard you sit down at the piano and play your first chord, he thought, wow, that's really great. And that he's a pianist, that he should let you play piano while he moved over to electric piano playing behind you. Were you pleased that he agreed that you should be the one at the piano?
I remember that particular session. It was the very first session, so naturally, yes, I remember it. And we really were kind of struggling at that point to get to the music. It just wasn't quite coming off, although we had dynamite players. We had the Muscle Shoals section, and they were really very, very hot, cutting a lot of good greasy stuff, or what you would call greasy in that day. But we weren't getting to the music in the way that we should have. It just wasn't coming off. And finally, someone said, Aretha, why don't you sit down and play? And I did. And it just happened. It all just happened. We arrived, and we arrived very quickly.
Aretha Franklin spoke with Terry Gross in 1999. This week, Franklin was awarded a Pulitzer Prize Special Citation and a new documentary about her 1972 gospel performance called Amazing Grace is now in theaters. Franklin died last August at the age of 76. Coming up, Justin Chang reviews the new film Long Day's Journey into Night. This is Fresh Air.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Mayo Clinic. When the search for the right answer becomes the most important journey of your life, when a clear diagnosis would mean the world to you, when finding new options could help you find hope, you know where to go. Mayo Clinic. Find out more at mayoclinic.org/answers.
Hey, y'all. I'm Sam Sanders. I host an NPR show called It's Been a Minute. Every Friday on the show, I talk out the week of news because sometimes the best way to process everything going on right now is through good conversation. Download the show, and we'll process everything together.
Long Day's Journey into Night is the second feature from the Chinese writer-director Bi Gan. The film has been a critical sensation since it premiered at last year's Cannes Film Festival. The movie features a nearly hour-long 3D sequence as the story follows a former casino manager haunted by the memory of a woman from his past. Film critic Justin Chang has this review.
Bi Gan's Long Day's Journey into Night is the most magical movie I've seen in many a moon. It's a beautiful and sometimes baffling noir romance that borrows visual styles and motifs from filmmakers as different as Alfred Hitchcock, David Lynch, and Andrei Tarkovsky. Its chief innovation, however, feels like something new, a 59-minute sequence shot in a single take and converted to 3D, that stands as one of the great poetic and technical achievements in recent filmmaking. To answer the obvious question first, this Long Day's Journey into Night shares an English title, but not a plot, with Eugene O'Neill's classic play. The Chinese title translates more accurately as Last Evenings on Earth, which is also the title of a short story collection by the Chilean writer Roberto Bolaño. Most of Bolaño's stories are about solitary wanderers going on mysterious quests in Latin America and Europe. The movie captures something of their restless, lonely spirit, even though it takes place half a world away in Director B's hometown of Kaili City in southeast China. A handsome divorcee named Luo Hongwu, played by Huang Ju, has returned home after his father's death. As he wanders the area, with its rain-washed streets and rocky tunnels, he begins searching for a woman he loved long ago. She's played by the actress Tong Wei, from Ang Lee's movie Lust Caution, and whenever she appears, always wearing a green dress, we know we are lost in either a memory or a dream. You can sense the influence of the great Hong Kong director Wong Kar-wai in the story's fragmented structure, its themes of lost time and remembrance, and its seductive, almost fetishistic attention to visual detail. He's also there in the protagonist's dreamlike voiceover, which casts a veil of melancholy over every image. But compared with Wong's movies, Long Day's Journey into Night feels almost completely unbound by narrative logic. The first half flows from flashback to reverie to present tense reality, with little effort to differentiate among the three. Luo tells us more about his past, about a childhood friend who was killed years ago by a local gangster, and about a book containing a magic spell that, according to legend, could make your house spin. How these details and symbols all fit together is a mystery the movie has little interest in solving. Director B knows that we sometimes go to the movies to lose ourselves, and getting lost can be beautiful, even pleasurable. About halfway through the story, Luo enters a movie theater and puts on a pair of 3D glasses, which is the audience's cue to do the same. Suddenly, we are transported alongside Luo into a dark cavern. He walks out, rides a motorbike some distance, and ziplines down to a small village, where several beguiling encounters await him. All this is captured in one seamless shot by a gently flowing camera that, combined with the effect of the 3D, makes us feel as if we're floating through space. Recent Hollywood movies like Gravity and Birdman have made clever use of long traveling shots, achieved largely through editing and visual effects trickery. But Long Day's Journey into Night is a much more analog, handcrafted affair, which makes its achievement all the more astonishing. By all accounts, the shot was fiendishly difficult to plan and choreograph, and the effect is one of sustained tension and wonderment, like watching a metaphysical Rube Goldberg device play out for close to an hour. Details from the first half turn up mysteriously in the second: a piece of fruit, a karaoke performance, and a beautiful woman who bears a striking resemblance to Luo's former lover. That's a clear reference to Hitchcock's Vertigo, the greatest film ever made about romantic obsession. The bifurcated structure of Long Day's Journey into Night is very much open to interpretation. I felt like I was being told the same story twice, in two different but equally moody registers of dream logic. In the first half, the ground is forever shifting under our feet, as each new scene seems to reset the narrative. The second half, with its unified flow of action, is easier to follow, but in some ways even more mysterious. There's something incredibly poignant about the movie's notion that the past is always with us, even as time just keeps on going and going. If movies are dreams, then Be Gone never wants us to wake up.
Justin Chang is a film critic for the LA Times. On Monday's show, in 2017, U.S. Navy destroyers collided with large commercial ships in two separate incidents in the South China Sea, killing 17 American sailors. We'll speak with ProPublica's T. Christian Miller, part of an investigative team that found chronic understaffing and other problems affecting ships in the Seventh Fleet, which responds to threats from China, North Korea, and Russia. Hope you can join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hertzfeld. Our associate producer for digital media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.